All right, welcome to the Rational Face podcast. This is Jeff Nelson, and today I have the pleasure to interview Jennifer Mackley. She is the author of a new book out called Wilford Woodruff's Witness of the Development of Temple Doctrine. Jennifer is an attorney in Seattle. She's married, she's active, and has been an amateur historian or just a fan of reading up on Wilford Woodruff and his journals? And
my interest was purely historical and developed over the years. So,
okay. I first met Jennifer through a group of Wilford Woodruff descendants, and her research has been fantastic with regards to Wilford Woodruff.
It's been an amazing journey because Wilford Woodruff's descendants are such an incredible group of people. But I didn't contact them initially in my research because I kind of felt like a groupie. And yet one of his great-grandsons attended my presentation in St. George 3 years ago and then contacted me and asked if there was anything that they could do to help with pictures or historical documents to assist in my research. And then two of his great-grandsons ended up reading the manuscript, and the family genealogist worked with me to develop the ultimate record of his wives and children that is also included as an appendix in my book. So they have been a great help. And I did present at the family meeting 2 years ago.
Yeah, I remember you sent me some of those slides. That was fantastic. I should also ask at this point, one of the things that really jumped out at me when reading the book is just how many fantastic photographs there are throughout the book. I mean, you don't go more than a couple pages without seeing a new photograph. Was it the Wilford Woodruff family society or association that was able to fill in all those photos?
I actually have the now largest collection of photos of Wilford Woodruff. And it was interesting to me that the family doesn't have all of them. And that's in part because when Wilford Woodruff died, his entire collection of all his papers, all his journals went to his wife, Emma Smith, mm-hmm. and then to her sons. So any pictures that anyone had in the family were those that had been given to their parents or grandparents during their lifetime. And The images are now housed at BYU or the Church History Library or the Historical Societies, the RLDS Church. So they're scattered all over. And the Utah State Historical Society has quite a collection. But what I was able to do was put them in chronological order and get a copy from the many different institutions. And Daughters of Utah Pioneers was another great resource. So it's a compilation of those. And I ended up not including all the ones that I found because with all the research I did, I have a second book coming, which is about Wilford Woodruff's wives and more the personal side of their lives. So many of those images will be in that next volume.
Oh, that's fantastic.
But it was, so much was preserved throughout his life, and I credit that to him because of his calling he felt to record this amazing journey through church history, not only for him, but for posterity and for the church itself.
Yeah, maybe this is a good time to kind of give listeners a brief, description of the book as a whole. So it's a very interesting narrative, and we've talked a little bit about this in the past. You have this mixture of sort of a biography of Wilford Woodruff and just kind of covering the events of his life chronologically, while at the same time, it's a book that also is essentially detailing out the development and the unfolding of temple practices and doctrines. And then you also, throughout that sort of narrative and also exploration of temple, you get to also see the changes that the church itself is going through. And so it's this interesting, almost, you know, braiding of Wilfred Woodruff's life with the temple development. And in putting them all together in that way, it, for me at least, it was paradigm shifting in that I saw, I guess, the influences that each of them had on each other throughout the development. How much of it was a wrestle for you to try to figure out how to strike this balance of telling the story of Wilfred Woodruff's life while at the same time telling the development of temple doctrine? I thought you did a great job with the balance, but how was that in trying to strike that balance?
Well, when the first time that it was reviewed, that was what the publisher said, was you have chosen the most difficult way to present this, which I didn't know any better, I guess, is the best response. But for me, the story of the restoration and temple doctrine was part of that, was like reading War and Peace, and I had to keep taking notes as I read his journals and as I read the journals of his contemporaries and their letters and just church history in general. So as I did that, I began what is also an appendix in the book, which is an outline, a kind of a timeline of church history and Wilfred Woodruff's life. And I couldn't find a better way to tell it, because if I had just presented a historical narrative, it would have become an encyclopedia. There was no way to include every source or every perspective. And the one that was the thread that went from the beginning to the end was Wilfred Woodruff. He not only lived these things, but recorded them. And that was the difference. The day-to-day unfolding was fascinating compared to those who wrote maybe a 3 or 4 page autobiography at the end of their lives and said, I was here at this critical moment, or I experienced this amazing, experience in the temple or with a family member or with the prophet. He wrote it every day. And for me, that was the critical element and the only way that I knew how to explain what had happened.
Yeah. You know, in that appendix that you mentioned, I did also appreciate that you included other things such as, you know, which president had just been elected and other events to kind of, you know, further help kind of tie in when these things were happening and what the environment was like. I really appreciated that being in there.
Well, and one of the reasons for that was I initially started my research because of Wilfred Woodruff's vision of the signers of the Declaration of Independence in St. George Temple. And I was studying the lives of those men, and particularly the women that were part of the eminent men and women he chose to direct, you know, the temple work to be done for. And so it was trying to understand if they were his contemporaries, if they were, you know, lived before he did. And George Washington was the only one that was not a president during his lifetime. And so it became so much more personal that these weren't historical figures for him. These were men that he had grown up knowing, if not meeting them, you know, they were the presidents of the country that he lived in. So it was things like that, that for me, I had to get straight in my own mind before I could try to share with anyone else.
Yeah, I appreciate that a lot. And, you know, the other thing that came to mind when you were discussing how great it was that Wilfred Woodruff had recorded these things just constantly as they were unfolding. When I initially started reading the book, I guess I wasn't entirely sure what to expect with it, you know, to what degree it was a history book, to what degree it was an analysis of, you know, temple doctrines and temple rituals. And at first it struck me as seeming very, I guess, apologetic in nature. But as you note, even in the, you know, either the introduction or the preface, you know, you'd said that you set out to try to just tell things in Wilford Woodruff's own words, and that you were setting out to describe, I guess, Wilford Woodruff's life and the unfolding of these temple doctrines through his sight and through the way that he experienced it. And when keeping that in mind as sort of the lens through which this book was being written, it definitely helped me to better grasp, I guess, some of the decisions that you made and how to present things and what to include. How difficult was that to try to only include, you know, Wilford Woodruff's views on these things, and yet at the same time be able to kind of piece together the narrative to make it flow?
Well, it is a question that I have been asked, or reviewers have suggested. I didn't say enough about the Adam God teachings at the Veil, or I didn't explain or connect more between the endowment and masonry, or I didn't cover some of the political interaction between the church and either the federal government. Right. And there are so many things. I mean, 7,000 pages of his journals and 11,000 letters and 3,500 discourses. And he did experience, you know, the 1833 to 1898. And Thomas Alexander's book covers the historical side of Wilford Woodruff's life. And Cowley's book was also exactly, you know, the religious side. And this is Wilford Woodruff's personal perspective. And if he didn't write about it, I couldn't pretend to know what he thought or put in what other people were thinking at the time. And so there are some things that I discovered digging deeper that had not been published before. For example, his history of masonry. But those were things that he didn't connect to the temple. And so for me to include those as part of the temple doctrine from Wilford Woodruff's point of view would not have been an accurate portrayal of how he saw this development.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as I, you know, sort of reminded myself that you had, you know, from the very beginning set out that that was the approach you were taking. With that in mind, I you know, was perhaps a little less confused of, like, why didn't she discuss this item more? You know, like you mentioned with the masonry in the temple, where I felt like, well, if we're discussing the development of temple doctrine, it seems like that would be worthy of some amount of discussion. But as you point out, Wilford Woodruff himself doesn't really say all that much about it. Could you let us know, maybe just a little bit, what is it that he did have to say when he wrote down his history of masonry?
Well, the fascinating thing for me was, I mean, he only mentions masonry 13 times in his journal, and it is just a mention that that's what they were attending, or there was a parade going on. So it was something that he was aware of, participating in, but for him it wasn't a conflict of religious versus personal, or that one excluded the other, or one, mm-hmm. you know, was part of the other. It just, they existed, and it didn't. It's not something he commented on at all. And the history of masonry was a document that was in his personal papers, but it was simply the transcription of a book that had been printed about 10 years before he joined the church, and was, again, just a description of what Masons practiced at the time. And he makes no connections. It's not a complete transcription. It's not, it's just about 13 pages that he wrote down, and there's no parallels that he draws. There's no reference to temple ordinances. And so those are the kind of things that were critical in my analysis, and that's why they're included in the footnotes. And if there's mm-hmm. information on those things, then I include a paragraph or two in the footnotes, because it is something that people are interested in and want to know more about. And that's why there are over 1,000 footnotes in the book, because there is so much more to learn and so many things that have been written, but not something that Wilford Woodruff himself wrote about, but certainly worth studying.
Yeah, and I should also, I guess at this point, mention, follow along the footnotes when you read the book, because they are very well done. As you said, you know, when you would come to topics where maybe Wilford Woodruff himself didn't have much to say about it, oftentimes you have included some fantastic commentary within the footnotes, and also, you know, you cite to really an incredible amount of fantastic resources within them. How long did it take you in terms of gathering these bits of information that ultimately kind of made their way into the book?
15 very long years.
Oh, man.
I began before my children were born. I have 15-year-old twins. And again, it was just personal interest. And I said so often to my husband, did you know that Wilford was there when, or did you know that Brigham Young said, or did you know that Joseph Smith taught? And he started saying to me, you know, maybe you should write those things down. And I initially thought it was because he was tired of hearing them, but it was because it was fascinating. And we both consider ourselves well-read in church history, in the sense that it's an interesting topic. Mm-hmm. And you know, whether it's Heber C. Kimball or William Clayton or Brigham Young or, you know, any of those early church leaders, there have been so many books written and so many articles written. And yet what surprised us was no one has ever written about the development of temporal doctrine from 1823 all the way through. The articles address the endowment or prayer circles or, you know, the Kirtland era or the Nauvoo era. But to put it all together was something I couldn't find anywhere. And so that's what led to actually starting to write. And I initially just wrote articles. But when I began to present my research, that was the response I got. You know, they would say, I never knew this in context. I didn't understand until I heard you put it into context.
Yeah, you know, it was actually, that was one of the things that I really liked about it was sort of looking at the flow. And as you mentioned, just sort of the development overall, especially as you see it kind of, you know, in this particular timeline, and you see what's happening in Wilford's life, and what's happening in the church as these developments take place. Maybe it'd be a good time to go over maybe some of the highlights of that development itself. I guess as far as the early era temple doctrines, you know, you note in the book that Wilford Woodruff is away during the dedication of the Kirtland Temple, and he's assured by Joseph that, you know, you'll receive these blessings. And then, you know, I guess as we move along to Nauvoo, I think one of the things that people will be particularly interested in is the way in which you cover the law of adoption with a good amount of detail and context with it. So I'm sorry, I'm merging several questions together here. Perhaps at first, could you share some of your thoughts about, I guess, just how interconnected the purpose of all of these various temple doctrines and temple rituals, I guess I should say, are, especially when looking at adoption, sealings, baptisms for the dead even, you know, I'd love to hear you kind of just share some of your thoughts on the way that those are all, you know, very interconnected in purpose. And then maybe after that, we can start discussing a little bit more of some of the details and the timeline of the law of adoption itself.
Okay. For me, the law of adoption was something that I had understood in the baptismal sense, meaning we're adopted into the kingdom of God. And when I began reading his journals, that was a concept that the saints understood in Kirtland. And so when baptism for the dead was introduced, it made perfect sense to them that this was the fulfillment of the mission of Elijah, that this was how to bring families together. If those who had not been introduced to the church while they were living could still accept that after death, that they would then be adopted into the kingdom of God, into the family of God. And therefore, the hearts of the children and the fathers would be connected in that way. And Joseph Smith taught that exact concept, that vicarious baptism was the fulfillment of the mission of Elijah. And the reason that timeline of events from Kirtland to Nauvoo was so important in the development of the concept of the law of adoption and the sealing of families was he hadn't been taught about sealing. He hadn't, you know, received information on the endowment or any other temple ordinances, and actually announced in Kirtland that they had received all the ordinances that they needed to organize the kingdom of God. So it's those kinds of announcements and progressive understanding of what was happening that to me was not a problem, but something that highlighted the faith that these people had, that the revelations that Joseph pronounced were truly earth-shaking revelations, doctrinal changes that rocked the Protestant world. And the men and women who had joined the church, these were mind-boggling. And so when the concept of sealing was introduced, what Joseph Smith had said previously, you know, no longer applied. And again, it wasn't, for me at least, seen through the eyes of Wilfred Woodruff, it wasn't you got it wrong and now you need to fix it. It was, now we understand what this means and how it fits together. But as I read his analysis of the revelations and the developments, it was, they were being given one puzzle piece at a time, and they didn't have a box in front of them with a picture on it of how these pieces were supposed to go together. They had to figure it out as they went. And it wasn't, again, from Wilfred Woodruff's point of view, and as I understand, it wasn't that they felt God wasn't telling them what they needed to know. It was, he was helping them take one little piece at a time. There was no way for him to just lay the puzzle out and say, this is what it's going to look like in 100 years. But it had to be one piece at a time. So the law of adoption, as it applied to sealing, wasn't introduced until 1844, when Joseph Smith himself finally understood. And it was in March, 3 months before his death, that he said, to truly fulfill the mission of Elijah, we need to connect families. And that means seal yourselves to your fathers on earth and then to your fathers in heaven or in the spirit world. And so it took 21 years for Joseph Smith to go from the introduction of the mission of Elijah in 1823 to the understanding of what that meant and how that fit in with this temple doctrine and family organization.
Okay. So one thing I might ask, and let me know if this understanding is off at all. But the way it kind of struck me upon reading all this was that, I guess, as the further ordinances were revealed, it was less something that was this brand new, amazing thing, and more that it was an additional ordinance that was more of a refining or of a, I don't know, let's say a greater definition of the very thing that Baptisms for the Dead set out to do to begin with. Again, this sort of adoption into the family of God. And that, you know, as you know, washings, anointings, the endowment, sealings came out, it was just maybe a more refined approach to bringing together and sort of adopting into the family of God. And then as you add to that, to the sealings, this law of adoption, that it's just sort of additional steps. You know, I come at a lot of this from this. My background is in physics, and specifically looking at imaging, medical imaging, and things of that nature. And, you know, you can think sometimes when you have a picture loading online, oftentimes you'll get it. The general picture, you'll see the whole thing at once, but maybe it's not as clear or defined. And then as the image loads, all that's happening is you're just getting more refining features to the image that are coming into picture. And I guess it's maybe a somewhat decent analogy of kind of the way that it seemed to me upon reading your book, was that each of these additional ordinances in large part were simply kind of adding definition to the general purpose that had already been laid out. Like Joseph said, you know, with the baptisms for the dead in Kirtland, that, hey, this is what we need to fulfill the prophecy of Elijah. To what degree is that accurate, or is that just, you know, my take on what was there and perhaps not quite what Wilford had in mind?
Well, I think looking back, we see the finished puzzle, so to speak, and it's easy to try to make it look like it was a step-by-step process up a defined staircase. And for them, it was more of a zigzag, I think, because initially the saints understood the concept of sealing the same way that, you know, the Bible talks about it, where it was more an earthly validation of an ordinance so that it would be recognized in heaven. And the God would recognize that ordinance as valid in this life and in the life to come. And the Kirtland Temple involved just washings and anointings. And of course there were priesthood blessings and they had patriarchal blessings at that time, but the concept of sealing an ordinance versus sealing one individual to another was something that had not even been considered. And the sealing ordinances that begin in Nauvoo paralleled each other initially. So the sealing of a marriage covenant, and then as that developed into the actual sealing of an individual to another individual, the other parallel ordinance was the law of adoption in the sense of connecting the priesthood. So individuals were sealed to each other. And in addition to that, Joseph had talked about the need to connect the priesthood through the prophets back to Adam. And that was not an ordinance that he performed in his lifetime. In fact, he didn't even perform an ordinance to seal children to their parents. Neither of those ordinances occurred until the Nauvoo Temple was completed in 1845. And that's where the law of adoption comes in. When men and women were sealed into or adopted into the priesthood lineage of another man. And the law of adoption was to accomplish what sealing couldn't do. For those individuals who joined the church singly, in other words, their parents didn't approve of their membership in the church, or their husbands didn't approve of membership in the church, there was no one for them to be sealed to. And the law of adoption solved that because they could be connected to the priesthood and be a part of that priesthood chain, link back to Adam. So men and women were sealed as couples, and they were then, the idea would be to be sealed to Joseph Smith as the head of this dispensation. And by virtue of his receiving the priesthood from Peter, James, and John, that would connect him across the apostasy, and the loss of the priesthood back to the prophetic priesthood of the early saints and back to Adam.
Okay.
So it accomplished all of those very significant steps, which is why Wilfred Woodruff's change in 1894 made such a difference in what we consider, you know, the modern temple ordinances.
Yeah. Yeah, so there are definitely some things I think that we should probably clarify, because I'd imagine some of the statements you made probably had some people going, wait a minute, what was that exactly? So one thing that came to mind specifically is, as you mentioned, the unfolding of the sealing ordinances. You'd mentioned that at first there was just the generic sealing of a couple prior to there being a specific sealing of one person to another person. Could you explain that a little bit more, at least what you understood from reading through the history and Wilfred Woodruff's accounts?
Well, Wilfred Woodruff was the first one who actually wrote down, whether or not he was the first one who understood it, the idea of sealing individuals to each other. Because just as they had sealed priesthood ordinances of washing and anointing in the Kirtland Temple, the sealing of the marriage covenant, or in other words, taking what only man could do through time or mortality and sealing it so that those marriages would be effective beyond death, that was the priesthood power. So the sealing was understood as just the sealing of that marriage. And what changed was the understanding that what they were doing was sealing individuals to one another, such as husbands to wives or children to parents. And that was a significant difference. So when Doctrine and Covenants 132 was written down, those concepts are in there. That if a man marries a wife by any other authority, you know, they're simply married until death do you part. So that sealing had to occur, and that finally began to be the language that they used, was you were sealing first husbands to wives or wives to husbands, and then it was children to parents. But that again was a one-way concept, children to parents, and it wasn't until 50 years later that the idea that you could seal those children to parents and those parents to grandparents, to great-grandparents, became possible.
All right. Yeah. I mean, I think I would imagine that for several people, some of these, you know, ideas are going to be new for them. I would encourage them, you know, check out the book. It's great the way everything is, you know, lays out and you see this development take place. So there were some interesting comments from Brigham and others about the law of adoption itself that I thought were very interesting. And I was wondering, you know, what exactly your understanding or take was on some of this. One comment that stood out to me in particular when reading the book, and I believe it was a comment from Brigham, but I could be wrong, a statement along the lines of the law of adoption being like the highest and holiest of ordinances that we have here on the earth. I don't know if you recall exactly which statement that was, or if I'm correct in assuming that it was Brigham Young who had made that comment. You know, with the law of adoption being so little understood today, I'd be curious to hear what what your thoughts are on that statement in particular, and maybe how adoption was viewed by the saints kind of as time marched on within the church.
Yes, it was a statement by Brigham Young, and what he was trying to explain was why after the saints had to abandon the Nauvoo Temple, why couples were allowed to be sealed outside of the temple. So as they crossed the plains, when they got to Salt Lake Valley, they continued to do sealings of couples, but the sealings of children to parents and the adoptions into priesthood lineage were suspended. And they were suspended for over 30 years because he said those were higher ordinances and those could only be done in a temple. And part of it was practical in the sense that people needed to be married. And so the sealings of couples continued. But the other part was the understanding that the connections that were being made were formal. So the law of adoption continued as they crossed the plains, but it was more of a pledge that when a temple was built, they made lists of those who wanted to be adopted into a certain man's priesthood lineage, but those ordinances were not completed or administered in the temple until there was one, which was the St. George Temple. So that was part of his statement, the highest and holiest ordinances. The other reason was because it was second anointings were also introduced, and that was another description that was used for those ordinances as well. So what had been introduced by Joseph Smith, whether it was just as a concept, the law of adoption, or an actual ordinance like the second anointings, those were things that Brigham Young had to then implement and administer based on what Joseph had said instead of what he had done.
Okay. All right. And, you know, you mentioned that they had to wait on performing any of those until we get into the St. George Temple. And Wilford Woodruff, of course, then is the one who is acting as temple president in this, you know, first functioning temple that we have after Nauvoo. And another one of the chapters that I, you know, particularly liked and found insightful was when you were discussing the beginning of Wilford Woodruff's time there as temple president, and kind of the three significant changes that came about through Wilford Woodruff on some of the practices themselves within the temple. And so maybe you could give us a little summary of one of those. I know the one that particularly stood out to me was Wilford Woodruff praying to find out how on earth his family would be capable of doing the proxy work for his ancestors, and then receiving this answer that it's okay for other people to do the work for your ancestors. And this was considered a revelation by him, and there was a lot of celebrating and seemed to usher in this time in the temple where proxy work could then be performed by people other than descendants.
It is an interesting topic because for those of us who administer or participate in temple ordinances, it seems very logical that there would be some who would have thousands of ancestors that they could find and others who would have very few. But it was such a personal responsibility that the idea that someone could help you with your own relatives had not occurred to them. And Wilford Woodruff had been gathering information on his family members. He had more than 3,000 names that he wanted to do ordinances for, and yet he was the only one of his family that was in St. George at the time. And so he said he inquired of the Lord of how it was possible to get all these things done, and asked, you know, how to solve the problem, and said the Lord told him to call upon the saints in St. George to have them officiate. And what was interesting to me about this was that this revelation or this change came to Wilford Woodruff rather than to Brigham Young, who was the prophet and who was in St. George at the time and working in the temple with Wilford Woodruff and those, the others that Brigham Young had asked to serve. But he said that this was an incredibly important revelation, and with Brigham's permission, 154, I believe, women joined him in the temple to perform this work. And I did find the record of one of the women who said she had heard that Wilford Woodruff was, you know, looking for individuals to help, and that she hoped and prayed that she would be one chosen, because it was such a privilege to assist, because they wanted to return to the temple, and the only way to do that was if they were doing work for someone else. And this too was something that was fascinating, because again, we can repeat ordinances in the sense that we act as proxies, but at that time, the only people that were in the temple had to repeat those ordinances, to hear those promises or those blessings, were those who could work as proxies for their own family members. And if they didn't have that ability, if they didn't have that history, like Wilford Woodruff had, then they didn't get to go back. So women who couldn't serve missions at that time, women who, you know, didn't have another way to serve in the church, this was a big change for them, and they were very excited about it, that they could work in that way.
And perhaps we should clarify a bit too. This didn't necessarily apply to the proxy baptisms, correct? I mean, with proxy baptisms, there was more of a view of, you know, as long as you're a male performing a proxy baptism for another male, then that's fine, whoever it happens to be. But with the additional temple ordinances, is it just with those additional temple ordinances that this, you know, sort of rite of heirship, I think is how you wrote about it in the book, this, you know, this rule that you needed to be a descendant, it just applied to those other temple ordinances?
It was something that, again, developed over time, because initially women performed, acted as proxies for men and men for mm-hmm. women. It was something that, you know, as Wilford Woodruff talked about, they were so excited, they didn't wait for any further instructions. They just went right to the river and began. Mm-hmm. And it was Phoebe who wrote to Wilford Woodruff about the rules for proxy baptisms in Nauvoo, and said that Joseph had instructed that only if a ministering angel came to them could they do the work for someone else that wasn't a relative. And the development between Nauvoo and St. George was, it became more of a formal process, and that the baptisms needed to occur before the men were ordained by proxy, and that needed to occur before the proxy endowments. Mm-hmm. But that was something that hadn't been an issue in Nauvoo, because there were no proxy endowments. There was no proxy ordination. And that was something that had to be determined in St. George, and that was the first time that these things were written down. And knowing that there would be more than one temple, and that there would need to be administration, you know, over long distances when the prophet wasn't right there, all of those things required changes. And that's what was basically set in place in the St. George Temple.
Okay. What role did Wilford Woodruff play in terms of making adjustments to, or perhaps just formalizing temple record keeping? I know that there were records kept of the proxy work that had been performed prior to the St. George Temple work, but to what degree was that systematic? What influence did Wilford Woodruff have personally in that process?
He's not clear that he had any influence necessarily, but it was in the St. George Temple that they began taking slips of paper with the names of the deceased on them, and that they began preparing record forms to use, so that was not only a record for the temple. I mean, they had their own individual records, and most of the initial temple ordinances were written in individuals' journals, mm-hmm. because they were required to keep that record. And Wilford Woodruff preached a lot about that because people were not writing it down. And he said, you know, how are we to be judged out of these books that are written on earth if we don't write them down? Mm-hmm. So that was one thing that he stressed a lot, was just recording it. But they actually issued printed ward records and temple records so that the initial baptisms could be recorded, the baptisms for the dead, the baptisms for health, and the rebaptisms were all separate ordinances and recorded separately. So that was not necessarily something that Wilford Woodruff himself was in charge of or directed, but was a part of the process that Brigham Young began in 1877, and that then changes were made over the years on who had to sign recommends, or, you know, what columns were recorded in these, you know, necessary in these individual records.
Mm-hmm. Another question I have, it seems like, you know, upon reading your book and also just reflecting on things, it seems as though Wilford, perhaps more than any of the other apostles at the time, perhaps in large part because he was the temple president, seemed to really grasp on to the importance of temples and proxy work. You cite some speeches that he gives in which he essentially says, hey, doing this proxy work is the same as going out and doing missionary work for the living. Like, this is very vital. We need to do this work. It's just as important, if not more so. To your knowledge, were there any other apostles kind of during that time period in the late 1870s, 1880s, that were, I guess, addressing this work of redeeming the dead in the same manner that Wilford Woodruff was?
The short answer is no. It was something that Wilford Woodruff seemed to understand from the very beginning. And it may have been his sensitivity to his own family and the deaths that they experienced. His mother died when he was 15 months old, and his father remarried, and five of the six half-siblings that he had died when they were young, one when he was in his 20s, and then his only sister after she was married but still had no children. So it may have been those kinds of losses that from the very beginning of his conversion to the church, he was concerned about their welfare, and each revelation that Joseph received, he was thrilled. He talked about the joy of understanding that there was not just a heaven and a hell, that there was a merciful God who understood that there's no bright line. But it was also, even in Nauvoo, after Joseph Smith and Hiram Smith were killed, he said to Brigham, you know, are we going to continue baptisms? And Brigham said, you know, that's it's really not my focus right now, but Wilford Woodruff continued them. He was the only one that performed baptisms for the dead as they came across the plains. And it was something that he was involved in the endowment house, in the council house. And then, you know, it showed when he was called to be the first temple president. And even John Taylor recognized that Wilford had this focus and recognized the significant experiences that Wilford was having in St. George. So I think the answer is he did have that single focus, and it continued, and it showed, at least for me, why he was the one chosen to continue these things. I mean, as I said, my initial research was into his vision of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, and my initial question was, why him? Why didn't they come to Brigham Young, or why didn't they appear to somebody else and say, can you take care of this? And I think it was because he was that focused on it. So,
yeah, and you know that his focus on that was also key to one of the insights I got from your book that I hadn't necessarily viewed in that specific manner before. You know, you described the events leading up to the issuance of the manifesto in 1890. And I like the way that you had phrased it in that, you know, Wilford, in praying about what to do, that the nature of his questioning changed when there was the very real and imminent threat of losing the temples. And, you know, as is made clear when you reach, you know, that stage in the book, and I guess even, you know, from listening in on this discussion, it should be clear that Wilford Woodruff had a real love and devotion to the proxy work in the temple and the work of redeeming the dead. And, you know, it was a very precious experience to him. And so when suddenly there's this very real and imminent threat that the temples could be lost, that seemed to change the nature of his questioning and prayer and concern. Is there anything that you would perhaps highlight or better define of what I attempted to recall from your book with the events that led to kind of the change in the types of questions that Wilford was asking?
That was something that was interesting to me, and maybe partly because I'm an attorney and a former prosecutor, but just the political maneuvering and the legal battles that they went through, especially in the late 1880s. And I just thought, you know, he had stood and said as adamantly as John Taylor or Brigham Young, you know, we're not giving up polygamy. And I mean, it was ever. This was,
yeah, I mean,
something
even, wasn't it just a year before the manifesto that he had a speech that was very explicit that this wasn't stopping?
Yes, and that's why the about face to me, I just thought, you know, people can say it was political pressure, and of course that was a factor.
Yeah.
I mean, the understanding the context of what was going on, the persecution that they were under, the taking of the perpetual immigration fund, you know, not allowing them to be citizens, taking away their right to vote or hold office. I mean, all those things are why they left the United States to begin with, so that they could govern themselves. And they had applied for statehood 6-7 times by then, and being turned down meant they were still under the thumb of the federal government, and they wanted to be able to choose their own, you know, politicians and make their own laws, and none of that was going to happen. In fact, it was going backwards. So I thought, you know, of course that's why. Then why this sudden change? If that had been going on for, you know, basically 40 years, why this about face? And understanding the timing of the dedication of the Manti Temple and the change in who was handling the escheated property and what was next was when they said, you know what, we're not going to stand by our agreement. We said that those buildings that were used strictly for religious purposes would be safe. We're going to reconsider that. And so his statements, we must do something to save our temples, you know, that was the change. And that was August 16th. So, you know, the end of that month, he left for California and come back. And, you know, the day after he comes back, you know, calls him together and says, you know, this has changed completely. And it makes sense when you understand that that one statement, that one change in the law, that, you know, the from the Supreme Court, from the Utah Territorial Supreme Court, that they couldn't agree to what they'd agreed to, and that they would take the temples. And that's why when you read his speeches following the manifesto, that's what he says over and over again. And he did get a lot of flack from members of the church and, you know, people in the government, you know, politicians. You know, this isn't real. You're just saying this. And that's why the statement by the man who had been handling the case, was so significant for me, because he said, you know what? None of that would have mattered. You know, people would have continued, you know, to defy the law if they didn't believe that he was a prophet and that what he said was what, you know, needed to happen. No pressure from politics would have changed it. And
yeah, I mean, they certainly hadn't really curtailed much up to that point, and there had been many drastic measures. One thing that it caused me to just contemplate, and obviously there's no real way to answer this, but you know, I wondered what would have happened had a different person been, you know, the president of the church at that time period, other than Wilford, who, you know, very, very likely more so than any of the other church leaders at the time had such a deep, you know, affinity and love for the temples. You know, what might have happened had a different leader been in place when that was, you know, those events were happening.
As I studied this time period, especially the personalities of Brigham Young and John Taylor and Wilford Woodruff, I don't think that the church would have survived had John Taylor been prophet at the time, mm-hmm. in the sense that property would have been taken. The government would have taken the temples, the ability for people to join this, you know, join the saints in Utah and get across the plains, you know, the immigration fund, the cattle herds, you know, the sheep herds, all of those were taken, and they couldn't have more than $50,000. I mean, that would have stopped the church growth. And they may have been able to hold on to polygamy, but they would have been in prison. And they wouldn't have been able to work their farms. And it was all those things that he said. And John Taylor's defiance was not Wilford Woodruff's personality. Given the context of what he was doing, and yet John Taylor's place in church history and his role in what happened was, you know, I think what he was there for. Brigham Young is the same way. They each had a role and they fulfilled that position. And Wilford Woodruff couldn't have led the saints across the plains. And I don't think Brigham Young would have responded the same way that Wilford Woodruff did in 1890. So, mm-hmm. Of course, it's all, you know, just complete guess.
Yes.
But
yeah.
But he was a different personality, and he did have a different approach, and he did have a different perspective long term, and that was something that changed over the course of his life as well. I mean, his millennial point of view and his waiting for that salvation, that God would, you know, fight this battle for them. I think he was surprised at the answer he was given. And yet he did what he felt he was told to do. So it's interesting on this point. One of the reviews that I received was the Kirkus review, and they basically said, you know, that the author does not make any attempt to convert, which I thought was interesting because it's just a presentation of what he witnessed and what he believed. It's not, I think you should believe this too.
Yeah.
That's not the purpose of the book. And there are those who say, you know, you can't just say because God said so. That's not the answer. But for Wilford Woodruff, it was. So I'm not going to put words in his mouth and say it was for any other reason than because God said so.
Yeah. And again, as I said, when I was reading the book, when I really stopped and then instead of you were writing it to show Wilford's views on these things, it definitely helped to kind of put that into perspective. But I could see how there could be people coming at the book really from both ways of accusations of, you know, you presenting things in such a way so as to destroy people's faith. Or I could see many people looking at it and saying, well, this is nothing more than a church missionary tract in disguise. They struck a pretty good balance with approaching these things in that way. I guess to kind of draw towards an end here, you know, around the same time, we also get Wilford Woodruff having more impact on some of these temple rituals. Could you give us just a brief review, I guess, here at the end of Wilford Woodruff's life, where it seems that there's a bit of a curtailment of the rebaptisms for renewal of covenants, you know, a cessation of the practice of the law of adoption, and really kind of the unfolding of much of the temple work as far as proxy work is concerned, really largely to the way that we still, you know, view and practice things today. Could you give us just a quick overview of maybe some of those events and when and how they played out?
Wilford Woodruff is talked about as the father of modern temple worship because it was in the 1890s that all these things changed. And again, for him, it wasn't this, you know, edge of the cliff turnabout. It was a progression that occurred naturally. Rebaptism had been introduced by Joseph Smith in the 1840s and Wilford Woodruff himself had been rebaptized 7 times, Brigham Young at least that many. And for them it was a recommitment. It was a new beginning, whether it was entering the valley or being rebaptized before they went to the temple for the first time. And things changed, in the sense that, you know, the fonts in the temple became a place for baptism for the dead and not for rebaptism. And all of those ordinances became more formalized in the sense that they weren't occurring in rivers or streams. They were only occurring in the temple. And that was something that over time also individuals were feeling like that was diluting the significance of their original baptism. And so that was something that they discussed over the years, and it was in the 1890s that those changes occurred, that rebaptism was not, no longer something that you did to recommit. It was, you know, partaking of the sacrament. Mm-hmm. And even that was something that over time, you know, that didn't occur every week from the beginning of the church. You know, that was something that was formalized. And the law of adoption was the biggest change, and that was in 1894, when he just said, you know, Joseph Smith didn't feel right about this, Brigham Young didn't, John Taylor didn't, and now we know what God wants us to do. And it wasn't until then that they could actually do what he said, quote, God intended. And that was because it took 71 years for them to put in place all of those steps. You know, the restoration of the priesthood, the restoration of those ordinances, the conversion or the raising of generations within the church who could then be sealed to each other and the time it took to do the history and the research that would allow them to know who those ancestors were, and then to have people who were baptized and endowed and sealed within the church that could do the proxy work for those who had not had that opportunity in mortality. And finally, after 71 years, you have those steps that were needed to actually say, now we can begin sealing multiple generations, because we have proxy ordination and we have proxy endowments and we have generations to seal to. So it makes sense that adoption into someone else's priesthood lineage was no longer necessary because they had the priesthood lineage within their own family. And I think the critical difference too was Wilfrid would have said, you don't have to worry that they're not going to accept the gospel. You know, that's not our place. Our place is to do these ordinances, and it's up to them whether they accept them or not.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's great. And it was largely Wilfrid Woodruff, right, who's the one who kind of introduced that idea of saying, you know, don't worry about it. Like, basically, God will take care of it. If there are any issues, just get sealed to your ancestors and it will be okay.
Well, and he even went a step further to say there will be few, if any, who don't accept the gospel in the spirit world. And that was something that many church members had hesitated to seal, you know, to their ancestors because, you know, they were afraid. I mean, they had been disowned when they joined the church. So it was, you know, understandable that they would be concerned. But the revelation to him was honor your father, be sealed to him, and don't judge.
So was that largely just a general view of Wilfrid Woodruff, kind of more of a universalist type view of the eventual salvation of the human family, that, you know, I guess perhaps looking at the eventuality of every knee bowing and everyone largely, you know, with rare few exceptions, everyone accepting the gospel and moving together forward as an eternal sealed family.
It was something that he hoped for before these ordinances ever were introduced, before he was ever introduced to the gospel. He said, I just didn't believe that an innocent child would be judged, you know, the same as someone who'd lived a life of sin. You know, neither of them were baptized, and yet, you know, how could God be a just and merciful God if those two individuals were treated the same? So it was something that he believed that God should do. And as these revelations occurred, he wrote pages and pages about how important it was to know that God was reasonable and merciful and just, and that these things made perfect sense. But he had never expected them to be so clear, and that there would be ordinances that would accomplish what he thought and hoped would be possible.
All right. Well, you know, thank you so much again for writing this book and for talking with us today about it. If I guess at this point, I'd like to, you know, invite you, if there's any thoughts that maybe you'd like to share, things that you learned that stood out to you, or perhaps even just a message that you feel is of maybe kind of utmost importance that we can take from the life of Wilfrid Woodruff and the development that occurred with the temple practice. I'd just love to hear your kind of final thoughts and summary on that.
For me, the most important message of his life was that it is a process, that what he learned through it was that the faith is required, and it's not just the process for the church, although the church had to go through the process, or for a prophet, because he didn't expect perfection nor did he believe he exemplified it. So it was, this is a process for each of us as individuals, and it is a process for us as a church. And for him, there was not a problem having continuing revelation, which meant change, when you also needed to have that perfection in mind, because it was truly that, the definition of completeness. And complete, he said, the gospel will never be complete. Revelation will never be perfect because it goes through us. And to me, that is both comforting and disconcerting at the same time. And I think that's why this book is comforting and disconcerting at the same time. But the message I hope that people receive is these teachings, this history, this development is right in front of us. The footnotes don't go to some obscure source. They go to the Doctrine and Covenants. They go to the history that we have and that we've always had, but it's something that we have to understand in context. And that's what I hope this book will provide.
Yeah, thank you so much. I had very similar thoughts upon finishing it, with that idea that I hope that people can read this and realize that if we want to say that we're part of a true and living church, that we need to recognize that part of living is growing and adapting and changing. And as you mentioned, it's both comforting and disconcerting. And I think that maybe for the last, I don't know how long in the church, that the disconcerting aspect of a living organization has been what's kind of prevailed, and we've pushed more towards the church, you know, being complete, being perfect. And, you know, even just this last general conference, President Uchtdorf gave a talk about how the restoration is still occurring, and you know, this is a living church. And I think that your book does a fantastic job of highlighting those exact principles. So thank you again so much for writing the book, for coming on here. And I imagine that there will probably be some questions and comments for you regarding the book. And would you be able to kind of come on and check out some of the comments here and there on the blog? To interact with the listeners?
Yes, I would love to, because if this book doesn't start a conversation, then I've failed. So that would be great.
So please, listeners, don't let that fail. Get the book, check it out. I think it's a fantastic resource. And as I said, my initial reaction in reading it was that it was almost, you know, it was coming across to me as a very, very faithful perspective and approach. And it seemed to me like this would be, you know, this seemed much tamer than even, say, Rough Stone Rolling or some of these other books that are sold through Deseret Book. So if you're looking at sharing this with fans, I feel like this book of any of the books that goes into the, you know, more of the details of our history is a very safe choice and a very important one, as we've discussed. So please go check it out. And thanks again, Jennifer, so much for coming on here.
You're welcome. Thank you, Jeff.
All right. And thanks for listening. And please come to the blog and leave some comments.